What is... Dax, are you...
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge! Trucks up 3.9%!
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show. Let's do this Chris Herrington deal. Chris Herrington joins me now. Chris, maybe I should wait till we get to the refrain here before we, where we go. It's coming up.
You may have to wait a minute.
It's coming up. Is it? Okay, how long is it? Here we are. It's coming up. Yeah. Chris Herrington joins me now. Chris, what are we listening to?
So I guess I queued up one you knew today.
It's the right era.
Do it again. But,
it's the right era.
Do it again. Steely Dan. Steely Dan, not Yacht Rock, as Donald Fagan would tell you. Steely Dan, do it again in honor of the Grizzlies and Spurs, who will do it again tomorrow. Not tomorrow night. I'm just all over the place. We'll do it again tonight in San Antonio.
Yeah. And, Jeffrey, do you have that clip again? This is, can you queue up? We had a Vassell talking about this yesterday in San Antonio.
We're going up against in the West for a while.
I can't wait. Let's play them again and then again and again and again. I'm excited. Trust me. Can't wait to play them again.
In terms of trash-talking games, is San Antonio Memphis up there?
Them, Houston. Them the games you look at, I mean, obviously you look forward to all the games, but them games where you're chirping, you're going back and forth, that's you grow up playing like that, and that's exciting. So I know as soon as that jump ball, hopefully they don't call them a foul and jump ball, but as soon as that jump ball goes up, I know it's going to be a good one.
Seems like they want to get to it again. Do you enjoy these, by the way? Do you like the sort of, move to San Antonio for 3 days thing that they do in the NBA now?
I think I do. People have mixed feelings about it, but I think I kind of do. I think I like, we can't wait to get back at him kind of thing that he has going on, and you get to sort of tease out the matchups. We're getting sort of delayed versions of that. Like, we got that with Houston with a game in between, and we're getting with Minnesota, with a game or two games in between.
That's true.
That clip like sort of echoes for me of something I was just writing this morning, trying to write sort of a little preview story about the MLK game against Minnesota. And what I write about it in the first part of that is how, as much as people have been down on the regular season, I think based on not very much this season, there's so much competitive, hard-fought regular season basketball going on. And if you're looking at it just from a Grizzlies perspective, they got something going on, something a little extra texture.
Yeah.
It's like half the teams in the Western Conference playoff race. You got John Morant saying about the Lakers, I don't like them earlier this season, and John and LeBron going at each other. We all know about the Grizzlies-Warriors multi-season thing, the Draymond Green thing, which has extra energy now with Edie.
Yeah.
Houston has suddenly erupted as a thing. Clearly for the Grizzlies it's a thing. For Dylan Brooks it's a thing. The Spurs now is becoming a thing with Wimby and Wimby Edie. The Mavericks is not quite a thing, but I think from the Grizzlies' perspective, they've really struggled. They're in division. They've really struggled to beat Luka. I think that would get hot real quick if it were a playoff series. And, Minnesota's a thing, too. That's the one thing they've beaten in the playoffs. Minnesota, I think, really, if the Rockets are in the Grizzlies' head, I think the Grizzlies are in the Wolves' head. There's, some extra stuff going on, not with every, there's nothing with Phoenix I can think of. But with half these teams, there's really something going on,
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. A lot of fun. And I do think that dunk may not have happened, but it does. I think it puts something else extra in this, too. Right? There's a little resentment on the other side.
Yeah, no, it's great. This is the energy we want. This is what makes the games fun.
Yeah. All right. So we got that tonight. It is funny, though. So much of it is how it plays out. Like, there was no real juice in the Denver coming to Memphis earlier this year. Right. I mean, that was no Jokic.
Yeah, no. Denver's one of the teams where there's not really a thing going on.
Right.
Not yet.
And there was no Jokic. And so you're sitting there. You have two games in 3 days, and there was whatever, you know. So that one, that it doesn't always play out that well. It is funny, though. You're exactly right. This stuff is happening all over the league. And obviously the latest one was last night where Oklahoma City rolls over Cleveland after having lost 2 weeks ago. But we're sort of remembering that again.
Well, and then the undercard of that last night was, if you saw Detroit and Indiana, like, they were jawing at each other. Jamie Bickerstaff was jawing in the postgame, you know? Like, they're looking forward to the rematch.
Has it been? Yeah. You mentioned that there's been dissatisfaction or with the year. I guess there's dissatisfaction with the team. Like, what has been the?
I wonder if that's really true. I wonder if we overreact to, like, you know, loud, you know, people being loud on social media, right?
We do.
I think that's a reflection of overall sentiment. So I don't know if there is much. I think that there are people who are like something to be mad about every day about the Grizzlies for some reason. But I don't know. Like, I haven't taken a poll, but I don't know if, like, the fan base writ large is perturbed by anything. Like, you'd like to not lose to Houston three times, sure, but, like, you know, it's been a good season.
Yeah. No, I meant nationally, if there's some sense of that this year has not laid up. I don't get the sense there's any local dissatisfaction.
There was a whole bubbling earlier, the whole, like, you know, it happens every 4 months we do what's wrong with the NBA conversation.
So
that was happening earlier this year, and people pointing to the TV ratings and what's wrong with the league. There was a whole thing about what's wrong with the NBA. But that's been 20 years, at least.
All right. Well, we got Spurs and Grizzlies tonight. What do you think they're going to do with Edie tonight? Because clearly last night was, he did get the dunk early. Ja did get him involved early. But in the end, they were better with him off the floor. How do you imagine that plays out tonight?
Well, I think, you know, it's going to be the same approach, and we'll see if it's the same outcome. You know, I think Edie will start. I think it was good that they tried to get him involved early. I suspect that may be the case again. At least try to get him involved early. That doesn't mean he's going to dunk on Wimby again, but, like, I think the ball may find its way to him a little bit more frequently than it has in the past. And then once the game gets going, you coach the game, right? And so you just adjust to whatever's working or not working over the course of the game.
Okay, you've got a piece up that I would urge people to read. I've just tweeted it out, and it's about the Grizzlies' pace. And it's hard to describe, honestly. It's about pace.
Yeah, this is not one of those. This is like a one for me kind of thing.
Right,
this is
exactly
something I'd been thinking about and wanted to explore. It's not a game-to-game thing. I thought about it like a week ago, and I sort of held off on writing it because games kept coming and Drew had his Jenkins piece or whatever. But it's sort of about three trickle-down effects on the Grizzlies games of the pace they play or thinking about what they are. And the three of those are: does the pace they play inform, you know, the way they use players and how many minutes they play? Second, has it influenced the turnover problem they've had? And then the third thing, which has nothing to do with winning or losing, it's just the actual length of the games. A lot of people have noticed, like, how are these games taking almost 3 hours to play?
So just to go through those a little bit, as you point out at the beginning of the piece, everyone says we want to play fast. That's what everyone says in every sport, pretty much. They say they want to.
Fratello said that.
Right, they want to play fast. The Grizzlies are playing fast. How fast are they playing?
It's the fastest pace in the league this year and the fastest pace in the NBA, I think, since 2019, 2020, something like that. So it's not like an all-time record, but it's the fastest, the highest pace, / fastest, however you want to think about it, over the past 5 or 6 seasons in the league.
Okay. And this also means that, and this is sort of interesting, they travel more miles than anybody else?
So the NBA tracks this now, and, you know, and the Grizzlies even do, like, a bit with it. If you're in arena, it's like some FedEx, like, you know, player who traveled the most miles this week. They, like, do a little bit, if you notice some of the Jumbotron with this. The NBA has been using this tracking data for the last 10 years. And if you really hunt around, you can find it on the NBA website. Well, they'll measure, you know, feet traveled, miles traveled, average speed, all this stuff for teams and players. And so the Grizzlies' total miles, total distance they travel on average per game is the most in the league. And their average speed per game is the most in the league. And I think the distance thing is partly because, you know, the faster, about the speed with which they play. But I also think part of it is the style of play, right? You know, the cutting and the movement and the space. And so I think those two things compound each other. You're cycling through possessions faster, and within the possessions, you're moving around more.
Right. You're getting up and down the court more often, but then within every time you're up and down the court, you're cutting, and there's more distance that way. Okay.
Right.
Do you think this plays into the, you know, we always talk about minutes, how many minutes these guys get. Well, is it, if they're traveling further in those minutes, are those things related? Do you think that feeds
they
into
they are, but they are, but I don't know that the Grizzlies think about it expressly that way. Like, I don't know if they're looking at, like, you know, this guy traveled so and so miles this week. I don't know if they're connecting the dots. I don't know if they're connecting the dots in between, but they're connecting the two big dots. I do think that they are aware of their pace of play and the what that asks of players, and I do think that that connects to the deep rotation they use. Like, they draw a line between we use the deep rotation and we play fast. Those things are related to each other. And the deep rotation connects to not playing individual players as many minutes.
So this also leads, or at least partly responsible, to more turnovers. And whether you look at total turnovers or whether you look at turnovers with pace, you know, per possession, the Grizzlies are bad. They are very bad relative to the league. What you had this long conversation with, or there was a long answer from Taylor Jenkins, right, about types of turnovers. Tell me about that.
Yeah, this is a hard one. This is a hard one because if you want to really take his answer and pull it apart and analyze it, you could spend 10,000 words on this and, right, like, just try to get into it, but it's so complicated. They're basically different kinds of turnovers, right? Not all turnovers are equal. You know, there are live ball turnovers where you're like, you get a bad pass or a steal in the flow of play. There's dead ball turnovers where you throw it out of bounds and the team is now coming in bounds with it. You know, are the what turnovers are related to their pace of play and what aren't? That's subject to interpretation. What turnovers are related to their, you know, growing comfort with this new offensive system, and which aren't, that's you know, subject to interpretation. So one kind of turnover he talks about, which I think you can see a lot this season and more than in the past, is some of these bad pass turnovers on these cuts and drives, where, like, you know, you're driving to the basket and someone else is cutting along with you and you're trying to deliver the pass to them for these, you know, these backdoor layups, or you're trying to, you know, drive and kick it across the court for open three. And these are things that are part of the offensive structure. And sometimes they result in, like, backdoor layups and open threes, right? But sometimes you force the pass and they get stolen or they get knocked out of bounds. And I think there's been a little bit of a frustration this year, and Taylor Jenkins voices this occasionally, with the decision-making on these plays, right? That you don't have to try to force the pass for the backdoor cut because that's part of the offense if it's not there. And so I think there's an element here of the players still getting accustomed to this system, and that's part of it. I also think in terms of pace, and if you watch Desmond Bane in the last few games, I've seen a lot of this. They've got in their head so much to play fast, they get sped up and get ahead of themselves. You turn the ball over before you even have the ball, almost. I think there's been some of that. I think they are so focused on trying to go fast all the time that I think it's led to turnovers that otherwise would not have been there. Now, the question here is, like, what's the give and take? And I don't really get into this because I don't really have an answer, but it's an obvious question. What's the give and take? Like, they have a terrible turnover problem in a top five offense, right? So it's easy to say, like, just eliminate the turnovers, you're even better. But if part of what's made the offense good has also led to the turnovers, like, you know, if you overcorrect on the turnovers, is your offense also not as good? I think it's complicated.
Well, I mean, it does. There's two large questions here. One is, are they better off for having done this, A, in the regular season, and when they have a top five offense? We don't know what they would look like in an alternate universe where they didn't play this fast, right? So, but then the bigger question is, will they be better off in the playoffs for playing like this, right?
Yeah, and these questions are both on my mind. I did not go into those in this piece just because just strictly to express the ideas and make the observations takes enough time, right?
100%.
Yeah. I remain, by the way, agnostic about the stylistic changes. You can look at it and say, well, it's working, like they're top seven, whatever they are today, but they're like, you know, fifth offense and seventh defense or whatever. So what they're doing is working. They're third in the West. Well, 3 years ago, they were also like, you know, fourth on offense and sixth on defense and second in the West, you know, without doing playing different style. To me, it starts with the talent. And I think the team is good. I think they have good coaches and good talent, and those two things will win you basketball games. And I think they won basketball games with good talent and good coaching 3 years ago in a different offensive style, and they're winning it this year in this offensive style. I don't know how much I think that the style itself is driving that. I think it's more the talent. Now, if you look closely, you'll see that their half-court offense numbers have gotten better this season than they were 3 years ago, which is what they focused on. How much of that is because of what they're doing against the bad teams? How much of that will translate to the playoffs? I think that's an open question. I would say I remain pretty agnostic about both the pace. I think you're going to play fast because John Morant's your point guard. But broad, in terms of really pushing it, I remain pretty agnostic about both the offensive system and the pace. I think it's working fine, but I think it worked fine 3 years ago when they did different stuff.
You can read the piece at the Daily Memphian. The last thing that you do get into is the Grizzlies games. They've played a lot of long games. Why does pace have any impact, whether you get up and down the court a million times or half a million? Why does it have any impact on how the game is, how long the game is ultimately?
Yeah, this is the shortest and least important part of the column, but it's kind of funny to me to think, just to think about, does playing faster make the games last longer, right? It doesn't seem like it. That sounds counterintuitive.
Well, the opposite way, right, exactly.
Right. But, well, if you think about it a little bit, it should not matter, right? Because no matter how quickly you cycle through possessions, it's still a 48-minute game clock, right? And so you think about it, on first blush, it should go the other way. On second blush, it should not matter. But on third blush, it does matter because the more possessions you generate, the more of everything in the game you generate. And most of that doesn't matter to game length, except for one thing, and that's free throws. You know, the Grizzlies have, as of when I wrote it, I don't know if it's changed since then, but they were averaging the most free throw attempts per game of any team in the league and the second highest opponent free throw attempts. So faster pace equals more possessions equals more free throws equals more stoppages of the game clock equals a longer game.
There you go. Okay, last thing, Chris. David Lynch died yesterday at the age of 78. Your thoughts on David Lynch?
He was. There was no one else like him. I mean, as others have noted, his name became an adjective. He was a singular, absolutely singular filmmaker, which doesn't mean that I was a fan of all of his films. I was not. It doesn't mean that I embrace his aesthetic without reservation, because I sort of don't. But I think he made maybe a couple of masterpieces. Mulholland Drive is widely considered maybe the best film of the century, and I agree. And he made one of the most interesting things that's ever been on television, which is Twin Peaks. And so he had a particular style. His personal obsessions, his personal like sense of dream logic, like that can be really boring. But he was able to get it onto the screen in a way that kind of stuff, in a way that maybe no one else quite has.
Did you watch Twin Peaks? Where are you in life when Twin Peaks was aired?
I'd have to go back and look to know for sure, but I was like in school. I was in middle school maybe, but yes, I watched Twin Peaks in real time.
You watched it in real time. And by the way, when you say you don't like everything about his aesthetic, you have reservations about his aesthetic, two questions. What was the aesthetic and what would be the reservations?
Well, there was, I mean, it's a little bit too complicated to say what is the aesthetic.
Right? Right,
people have
books
about that or whatever.
Right,
but
yeah.
There could sometimes be a little bit of a leering quality in his stuff that I think attracts a lot of people, but it could also be a turnoff. And to me, it's a case-by-case basis. Like Roger Ebert famously hated Blue Velvet, which a lot of people consider the best movie of the 1980s, because he thought that he really hung Isabella Rossellini out to dry, that it was too naked a performance, both in body and in emotion, and that he didn't serve her well in that movie. He just sort of let her out there. I don't feel that way about that performance. I kind of feel that way about Roseanne Arquette, or Patricia Arquette, rather, in another one of his movies, Lost Highway. There's definitely a little bit of a, like, ogling, leering quality to some of his stuff. And to me, it's a matter of, like, what do you make of it, and what do you not make of it? And to me, that varies sort of project to project with him.
And what makes Mulholland Drive great?
We really don't have time for that. That's a movie a lot of people can't stand because they don't think it makes sense. I think everything that matters about it makes perfect sense. But I would say go Google and read some good stuff. I wrote a great piece on The Ringer about Mulholland Drive.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it. Have a good weekend. Chris Harrington will be back for the back in town for the MLK game, and you could read his preview of that. I guess it's going up shortly at the Daily Memphian. We're going to take a break. We got a special. Charles Fishman was not here earlier in the week. He was called away, and so we didn't have him, but he has agreed to a special appearance. So it's Fish on Friday, on Tuesday, on Friday. We'll do that next. Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. By the way, Monday we are off, but we got the Grizzlies here, the MLK game and the pregame. That's at 1 p.m., and then the national championship game at 6 p.m., so do not touch that dial. Special edition of Fish on Friday, on Tuesday, on Friday, joined by our man in Washington, D.C., Charles Fishman. Charles is the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, most recently One Giant Leap, about the extraordinary efforts of ordinary Americans to get us to the moon. Also a 3-time winner of the Gerald Loeb Award for Excellence in Business Writing and a retired Mississippi River tugboat deckhand. He joins me, special appearance now. How are you, Charles?
Well, I would say I'm chilly. We got a lot going on. Donald Trump's second inauguration.
Yeah.
This wasn't really on the list. I'm calling
it
audible.
You're audible. Here. Audible. You're good with the sports lingo.
I am. You know what I do? You know why I'm here today? I run through the tape.
You do.
I always run through the tape, and we're going to talk about what that means in a few minutes.
Uh-huh.
But
cold.
President-elect Donald Trump's inauguration on Monday. They are literally giving warnings to people who are planning to attend. In the morning, as you head out to the inauguration on the metro or some other way, it's going to be in the teens here, below 20.
Wow.
It's expected to rise by noon. That's the moment that Donald Trump will put his hand on the Bible, about noon. It's supposed to be about 20 degrees, but it has been trending colder in the models all week. Do you know when the coldest official presidential inauguration was and who it was? Do you know that?
I would guess it was, and because I say this because this was my era, it was Ronald Reagan in 1985.
That is exactly right. Ronald Reagan, 1985. I was a Washington Post reporter scheduled to cover the, I had a position on the inaugural parade route. Sorry, I pressed my own personal cough button.
Sorry, yeah.
We were all pre-positioned. And that morning, the Washington Post gave out pencils to go with our notebooks. They said, your pen's not going to write. You may not be thinking about this, but we are. The pens will freeze. And then they canceled the outdoor events for the whole inauguration. Ronald Reagan's inaugural was moved inside.
The amazing thing is, go ahead. The next inaugural.
Hang on one
go
second.
Ahead. Yes.
Uh-huh. Hang on one second.
Yeah.
It was 7 degrees outside that day. So that 7 degrees is really.
Well, it's interesting. You wonder. I mean, you're going to have all these billionaires sitting out there in the cold, and
I ride my bike in 20 degrees all
that's
the time,
fine.
And the audience may not know this, but I am not a billionaire.
No,
I
you're not.
Show
no,
even
no.
If
anyway,
I were,
so what I was going to say was that the next inaugural in 1989. I was supposed to go. This was back when I worked for a conservative judge, James Buckley, I had tickets to go to an inaugural ball, and I was, for some reason, I was in Buffalo, and I was snowed in. We couldn't get out of Buffalo. There was a giant-ass snowstorm in the next one. So we've had inclement weather before. You, by the way, before we move on to other things, you could get out there if there's snow. I gather you've had the experiment now. You've tried to snow shovel with your leaf blower.
We're going to go light on this. We got half an inch of snow last night at 7 o'clock. It fell onto our existing base of 8, 9, 10 inches,
uh-huh.
which it hasn't been above freezing. It mostly hasn't even been above 25 all week long. So that is rock solid and slippery. So this morning, after I walked the dogs, I had the experience like, okay, this is really a dusting. I took our leaf blower, fully charged, out, and I thought, this is it.
I'm going to leaf blow snow.
Yeah, you know what? It doesn't really work that well. Sorry. It worked great on the cars.
All right, I want to get to. We have so little time and so many things to get to. Tell me this.
Fridays always feel like that, don't they?
TikTok, is it going to go away?
Oh my God! Sunday? Do we have big TikTok news this morning?
What's the big TikTok news?
The Supreme Court upheld the legality of the ban.
Yep.
That Congress passed last summer. Unanimously, the U.S. Supreme Court, which only took up this case literally 9 days ago, they heard argument, they read the briefs, they ruled, they wrote a decision. The argument is you can't ban TikTok because of the First Amendment. And the U.S. government, in the form of Congress, said, TikTok poses a serious threat to the national security of the United States. TikTok, of course, is owned by a Chinese company.
Right.
The Chinese law says any Chinese company must turn over data about its customers to the government if the government says, now you must turn over the data. At any time, the government in China can simply say, we need to see the data about your customers. And 170 million Americans are customers of TikTok, use TikTok.
Okay.
Now, here's what's interesting. The law seems a little wacky. Like, how is TikTok's not going to launch nuclear missiles or interfere with the electric grid? Here's what's interesting. The National Security Services of the U.S., the CIA, the NSA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, have briefed members of Congress and senators on the threat that TikTok poses. And they go in there and they say, we're going to go to the briefing. We think this law is a little extreme. And does TikTok really need to be banned? It's just something people watch 30-second videos of. And then 2 hours later, they come out and say, we need to ban it. We need to ban it immediately. So whatever the intelligence people tell them, and then they can't say anything more.
Well, you say that, but although so what's going to happen by that? Just to point out, it's not going to disappear off your phone. You're not going to
wait a minute. Like we don't. Okay, so
hold on. Let me get a question out here. Let me get the question out. Then you can correct any misapprehension, any misstatements I make. My understanding and correct information. My understanding is it's not going to disappear off your phone. You won't be able to update it. It will therefore degrade, etc. But as all this is happening, you have Donald Trump, who has invited the CEO of TikTok to sit on the platform with him. You have a Senator Markey from Massachusetts suggesting a bill to postpone a new bill that would postpone the demise of TikTok, the previous bill, et cetera. Right. So not everybody, including the president and a Democratic senator from Massachusetts, seem to be convinced of the perils of TikTok. What the hell is going to happen?
Well, there's a lot in that question.
Uh-huh.
First, what's going to happen? The ban goes into effect on Sunday, the 19th of January. It was designed specifically to go into effect just before the new administration, and we didn't know who that was last summer. The ban actually targets not the app on your phone, but companies like Apple and Google, which offer the app in their app store. The fine for letting one person download the app or update the app is $5,000. So Apple and Google are not going to let 100,000 people update their app on Sunday.
But if you have it on your phone, it will stay on your phone.
Well, yeah, that of course, because you can't
reach into your phone like they would take away your guns.
Let me talk now.
Okay.
No one can. I have apps on my phone that no longer work. No one's reaching into the phone and taking them away. But what TikTok said this week, and it was hard to tell whether this was bullying and sort of a game of chicken or serious, they said they're going to turn the app off in the United States if the ban goes into effect. You aren't using, this is not like a clock app. When you go to TikTok, you're accessing the TikTok servers. That's the whole point.
So they could, in fact, turn off the servers.
They can turn it off, and they, the view was that in part they were threatening to turn it off so that literally half the adults in America would say, what in the world is going on? Get me back my TikTok. What the law actually said was you must either sell it to an American company, and therefore you get back your value, but you don't get to run the company anymore, or turn it off. And now, so it's unclear what will happen on Sunday night, whether they'll turn it off or not. The Biden administration has said preemptively, we're not going to enforce it. We're not going to levy fines on Monday night and on Sunday night and Monday morning as our administration winds down in the last 12 hours. We're going to leave that to the decision-making of the new administration. Donald Trump, famously, in his first 4 years, let's not forget, hated TikTok and tried to shut it down. He tried to shut it down unsuccessfully. Then TikTok became literally a popular way of Donald Trump promoting his candidacy, and now he is in favor of it. And he has said, that's why. I'm in favor of it because they like me. But Donald Trump can't simply undo.
No, he can't undo a law
made by Congress. And so it's unclear what's going to happen Monday. Several people have offered to buy TikTok. The Chinese company that owns it, which is named ByteDance, they own a bunch of social media apps of all kinds, they have said they're not interested in selling. So we're at an interesting standoff here. And let's pause and say, the Supreme Court actually got classified intelligence information also submitted under seal, but their decision says we didn't use that. What they said is the security concerns are serious enough that Congress has the right to legislate to protect us. And the security concerns are kind of twofold. This is interesting. One is that ByteDance and TikTok are gathering all kinds of data about you. That's how they give you videos you want to see. And what could they do with that data? Well, China is very good at holding on to data. And one thing they're worried about is that people who are 18 or 22 now, in 10 years, they'll work at Google. They'll work at the State Department. And China will go back and use the data they got now to hack those people. The other concern is that China manipulates the news.
Right.
62% of people under the age of 30 use TikTok. 62%. And of those, 59% say they get their news from TikTok. So that's serious access, right, to the American to American consumers.
And if you never let them see anything about how great Taiwan is, for example, you're manipulating the news.
Right, or torture the Uyghurs. Right. There's all kinds of reasons you don't want China to decide what the portrayal of China is. So it's here's what I would say. It's completely unclear what's going to happen. Americans love TikTok. You know, it was at one point the fastest growing social media app. Two more little statistics before we move on. 62% of the people who use TikTok regularly are women. And of regular users, 55% Democrats, 39% Republicans, and only 32% of adults in a recent poll support the ban. 39% of American adults say they aren't sure whether it should be banned or not. So we, as a country, the citizens don't quite know what to make of this. We don't normally ban stuff. You know,
we got about 2 minutes or 3 minutes left. Which of the topics remaining on the table would you like to take up?
We got to run through the tape really quickly.
Okay, go ahead.
This is crazy. I decided to look this up because I heard Lina Khan, the head of the FTC, the antitrust chief, say she's going to run through the tape to regulate companies. She was on CNBC on Monday or Tuesday. I heard Anthony Blinken.
A lot of Biden people are doing stuff right up to the end, and they're saying run through the tape.
Right.
They're going to right. We're doing this Mideast ceasefire. He literally said we're going to run through the tape.
Okay.
And I thought, now there's a sports metaphor yep. being used in a political context. I found one, two, three. I found six Biden administration people quoted in the last week: Pete Buttigieg, Lina Khan, the Secretary of the Army, Christine Wormuth, the EPA chief, Michael Reagan, Gina Raimondo, Anthony Blinken, all saying they're running through the tapes. So I went back and I tried to find where this had come from. And yep. as I told you, the earliest, I used newspapers.com, the earliest reference is, of course, a sports reference about
track.
Somebody in track and field running through 1860. Almost.
Not as a metaphor. That was actually about someone running through the tape. Yes, okay.
And then I went looking for the first actual metaphoric use. I just looked every 10 years. In 1990, when you read references to running through the tape, they were literally talking about videotape. You have to run through the videotape to see whatever, this scene in this show. The first reference I could find was November 2000 in the LA Times to a political reference. In 2015, a USA Today personal finance columnist used run through the tape in personal finance terms. Use it to push through to your savings goals. It was really in the Obama administration starting in 2016 as they wound down. So it's not a very old metaphor. It's
As
a political metaphor. Right. Right. A lot of references, by the way, in the 40s and 50s to running through the tape in sewing terms. Now, there's something Americans don't do much anymore. So, but there you go. So,
we have enough time. We're tipping less real quick.
We're tipping less. This was a great, if brief, story in the Wall Street Journal. Toast, T-O-A-S-T, is the firm that provides financial checkout when you order things at a restaurant, especially to go. It provides the digital check for restaurants, so they measure tips. We are tipping the lowest amount since before the pandemic in
total dollars or percentage. What is it talking about?
As a percentage, but the average tip is now 19.3%. So that's interesting.
Wow.
It's lower than it's been in 5 years, but as this story said, we are exhausted by being asked to tip. And it shows.
I'm astounded then that the average tip is 19.3%.
That seems high. It's particularly taken effect. The exhaustion is particularly prominent in the big cities. But this story pointed out, last year Americans ate less at sit down restaurants. 2024, fewer restaurant visitors than 2023. And you see that with Red Lobster and TGI Fridays.
All right, Charles, we really appreciate it. You were running through the tape this week. We appreciate it. Thank you very much.
On Tuesday.
Yeah, regular spot.
Time, 2 days in a row.
Regular
two shows
spot.
In a row.
Thank you, Charles. Appreciate it. Yeah, there is. Bye. That will, as it turns out, that'll be two shows in a row because we're not on Monday, but we got the Grizzlies game Monday. We got the pregame Monday. We got the national championship game Monday. It will be a busy Monday. What's coming up next today, Jeffrey?
Jeff, here's what's coming next on Jason and John. Parthipadhyay will join them at 1:25. Brent Rooker also going to be on their show. He was yesterday. I'm sorry about that. Tim Murray will join us today on Jeffrey Wright and Company. Blake Topmeyer going to join us. Eric also going to join us from San Antonio. Cobb will be the game at 5 o'clock.
Have a great weekend, everybody. We will be back on Tuesday. For now, our work is done, and go Bills.